From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL, The Doctor Is In, a bi-weekly podcast addressing common and some not-so-common technical issues in amateur radio. This podcast is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST Editor-in-Chief Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the Doctor himself, QST Contributing Editor Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Hello, I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
And I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Joel, it's time to talk keys and keyers.
All right.
Keys, paddles, bugs. No, actually, we'll talk keyers. How's that?
Okay, well, I was going to talk about all those things.
Well, then be my guest.
Yeah. Well, some kind of keying mechanism is, or device is needed in order to transmit using Morse code. We probably all know that.
Of course.
And that goes back before the days of radio. People were using Morse on wireline circuits for, 50, 60 years before they started doing radio. Now, it's no longer a requirement. It used to be when I started and when you started that all hams had to be able to pass a sending and receiving Morse code test to get a license. That's no longer the case. So a lot of people haven't gone through the process of learning the code, and we did spend a lot of time in an earlier podcast talking about the benefits of CW transmission for operating under marginal conditions.
True. And CW activity on the air is as high as it's ever been.
I think actually. That's true.
Yeah.
And the phone bands keep getting bigger because I think they think less people are doing CW, but I don't know if that's really true.
No.
And a lot of new hams that I've talked to have enjoyed getting involved with sending Morse. So it's a very useful mechanism as well as being a lot of fun. I personally enjoy it a lot. The other thing is, if you want to talk to a station and they only operate Morse, then it doesn't matter how big a sideband station you have. They're not going to hear you if they're listening to people on Morse.
Especially that highly desirable DX station.
Absolutely right.
Yes.
And they often operate Morse. Now, of course, most DX expeditions will operate multiple modes and get on digital modes and phone and CW and so forth. But it might happen that the only time you can hear them is when they're operating CW. So it'd be really good if you could communicate in that way.
Now, I bet when you're operating CW, though, you're not using a straight key, are you?
No, I'm not. I usually use a keyer.
We should define what a straight
key
is.
Yeah, the basic code key is a very simple device. I mean, they're very fancily made and precisely made, and you can spend any amount of money you want on one, but it's basically just a pair of switch contacts. You could tap two wires together.
Two pieces of metal coming together.
That's it. And just a momentary contact switch. But the key thing is they're made in a way that's easy for the hand to operate them. And not only operate them, but operate them fairly rapidly and operate them for long periods of time without getting the operator tired out, either in wrist or arm or whatever. It's usually referred to as a straight key. Some people call it a pump. And a typical basic key is activated with an up and down motion. We've all seen this.
Yeah.
Now, this can work very well and is fairly intuitive to learn to use, although I think most people would benefit early in their learning process by getting together with somebody that really understands how to do it, so they avoid learning and making some mistakes that'll be hard to break, turn into habits that'll be hard to break later on. I always went through that as a 12-year-old with a person down the street who was willing to sit down with me and show me how to do it. And you know, we can't do that very well by just telling you about it, but it's good to be there with somebody. Take your key and your code practice oscillator to somebody else that knows how to do it and have them get you started. I recommend that very much. But back in the early days, in the wireline days, before the end of the last century, the late 1800s, telegraph operators who worked 8 hours or longer shifts even, sending almost constantly, developed a particular malady called glass arm that made sending painful. And it caused them to not be able to send after a while.
Kind of like carpal tunnel syndrome?
It could have been, I guess, a similar kind of thing, if not the same. It might have been someplace else because of different motions involved. I don't know. I don't know what the actual malady was, but it was a problem. And there were a number of efforts made to try to avoid this. The first was to turn the key effectively on its side, make it a side swiper, so-called, which would be operated between the thumb and the index finger.
So instead of going up and down, the motion is side to side.
Side to side. And you could use, just on one side is a little easier to learn, but you could use either side and you could go back and forth, so forth. And that was quite popular for a while. But not long after that, and there were a couple of other things in between, but a fellow by the name of Horace Martin in 1904 invented a semi-automatic key, which was he called a bug.
Ah, the infamous bug.
Yes. Now, this was a device that operated much like a sideswiper, except the keying lever, similar to a sideswiper lever, but if pushed to the right, would make its own dots through a vibrating arm with a weight and a spring. And by moving the spring up and down the arm, you could change the speed of the dots. And it would typically do that as long as it was held there up to, typically the rule was that if it was set up right, it would go 40 dots before it stopped vibrating. Now, of course, there are no code characters, I don't think, with more than 5, so that made them fairly even during the code character. And it would restart again every time you'd push it again the next time.
That's pretty ingenious, really.
It was. And actually, they push it the other way, and you'd make your own dashes just as if you were a sideswiper. But some people, there were actually people who made fully automatic keys. They weren't as popular. And you had basically 2 rods and springs and things, and you could make dashes on one side and dots on the other. But the bug was very popular. It took a little practice and had a fairly steep learning curve, but it became popular with hams as well as commercial and military operators.
There are hams that still use bugs.
Oh, absolutely.
To this day.
Absolutely. And they're still available. The Vibroplex company, which has changed ownership a number of times since then, is still in business, and they still make keys that look very much like the original Vibroplex. So you might want to look that up if you're interested. For many hams, though, the space that the bug took on the operating position has been taken over by electronic keyers. That's what I use, and I have since probably 1960-something.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. How old are purely electronic keyers?
I'm not sure exactly, but I know the first one that I'm aware of, and I have one of these, it was made by Hallicrafters, the first commercial one that I'm aware of. It was the W9TO keyer. It may have been in the handbook or a QST article. It was designed by W9TO, and it was called by Hallicrafters the TO keyer. Vacuum tube with relays and so forth, and it had a built-in monitor, and it had a neon tube oscillator kind of thing that you could see the neon tube on the front. I remember that as, let's say, 1956, maybe sometime around there, within a few years of 1956.
It's kind of what I thought, yeah.
Yeah. Now, I'm not saying that there weren't other keyers before that. That's just the first one I'm aware of. And, of course, I became a ham in 1954, so I'm not too aware of what happened in 1943, for example, when I was 1. but they've been around. Now, the typical electronic keyer is driven by what's called paddles. Basic paddle looks an awful lot like a sideswiper, except that the contacts on the 2 sides are separate. So if you push it one way, it makes dots. You push it the other way, it makes dashes. And depending on whether you're right or left-handed, you can just switch the wire connections and you can make it work either way. So typically, pushing it to the right makes dots, as it did in the bug, but pushing it to the left sends continuous dashes, making it a fully automatic key without all the moving parts and complex devices of the electromechanical version. But the important thing is that the electronics of the keyer do a lot more than just send dots and dashes. They also self-complete, so if you start a dot or a dash and you let up the key lever too early, it will finish the character or the element for you. So you can't send dashes that are half as long as people will do when they're sending manually, for example.
Yes.
Or with a bug. In addition, you can't rush the space between code elements. It always makes a full space of the width of a dot. Mm-hmm. So that makes the timing come out better. So people that use electronic keyers tend to have more correct code characters sent. Now, of course, you can leave the space too long, and it won't know what you were intending to do. So you can still send bad code with an electronic keyer.
Oh, absolutely.
But it's harder. It's more likely that you'll send good code.
Well, Joel, how about if we take a break?
Okay.
And we'll hear from DX Engineering, and we'll be back.
Okay, I'll be here.
Remember your first contact? The excitement of that first CQ? The exhilaration of making your first QSO? At DX Engineering, we know that feeling too. That's why we've committed to making your on-air experience the very best it can be. DX Engineering ships quickly, which means less station downtime. And we have free shipping for almost any order over $99. We've recently expanded our inventory, so you don't have to wait for the gear you need. DX Engineering has introduced all new radio products and revived legendary brands, all with the goal of helping you enjoy amateur radio. Most importantly, the DX Engineering team is here to help you. You've got a team of highly experienced hams ready to work out technical issues, answer questions, and help you optimize your station performance. That excitement you felt from the first contact, it can happen again and again with help from DX Engineering. DXEngineering.com. That's DXEngineering.com.
And we're back, Joel. Still talking about keys and keys.
All right.
Can you define for me, because, you know, obviously for both of us, this has been around for a long time, iambic or iambic keying?
Yes. Iambic keying is a flavor of the electronic keyer. And basically, many keyer paddles actually have two arms. And what that means is you could actually connect both to the dot and the dash contact at the same time. Why would you want to do that? Well, if you, if you don't have an iambic keyer, I'm not sure exactly what it does. It probably does a dash because dashes tend to be dots filled in with spaces. But the iambic keyer takes advantage of the fact that you could do that, push them both together, and it sends alternating dots and dashes. You know, many characters are made up that way. Even letter C, dot. So dash, dot, dash, dot. So if you hit the dash first and then hit the dot and it makes alternating characters and you stop doing that at the right time, it will make the letter C. And that requires basically just one squeeze. They're often called squeeze keyers, I guess, because of that. So it takes a little more practice. And there's a couple other things. If you hold down, let's say, the dash lever, like you want to send a Q after the C, so you want to send da-da-da-da, if you hold down just the dash letter, it'll start sending continuous dashes, and just as it finishes the second dash, if you tap the dot arm or dot paddle briefly, it will insert a dot, and then it will continue sending dashes after that dot if you let the dot paddle go. All the completing of all that happens in the proper sequence with the proper spacing between the elements, so you get a perfectly timed cue. You don't have to switch back and forth from one side to the other.
It's always impressed me to watch somebody manipulating a set of paddles, somebody who's really good at it. You just see their thumb and their index finger just gently working back and forth and back and forth, kind of, well, unconsciously, really. They're not paying much attention, but they're sending perfect code. It's a thing to behold.
Well, it does send very close to perfect code, and it's hard to, you know, if you do it right, it can do a very good job. I guess when I started with my first electronic keyer in the 60s was one, I think it was one that I built. They hadn't talked about iambic keyers yet. So I learned on the single paddle type. My current paddle is iambic, but I don't use it that way. I just use it as if it were a regular paddle. And it's just a matter of training. I mean, your fingers get used to doing that, and you don't think about it. And once, once you're in that mode, it's very hard to do something different. In fact, before I did that, I used a bug regularly. That was my usual keying mechanism. And I've got a bunch of bugs still. And I can kind of send with them if I'm just practicing with a code practice oscillator. But if I get on the air with it, before long, my fingers revert to electronic keyer mode, and I hold the dash lever down, expecting it to send multiple dashes, and I get this very long dash, and I say, oh, crap. So I have to go and do something else. But it's interesting that I because the motion is so different, I do not have that problem with the straight key, which I learned on first, because it's up and down. I can send reasonably good code on straight key night with a straight key, but not with a bug.
Not with a bug.
That's
now,
it.
Now, many transceivers have keyers built in.
Absolutely.
Not all of them, though. And
that's
true. Instances you have to buy an external keyer, hook your paddles to that. Some hams who aren't familiar with CW get a little bit confused. They'll see a set of paddles and they'll think, well, that's all I have to buy. They don't realize that either the radio or something external to it has to be there as the actual keyer.
That's quite correct. And I'm not aware of any recent transceivers that don't. I'm sure some of the smaller ones probably don't have built-in keyers. By the way, that's not true of a straight key. To send with a straight key, all you need is a straight key and a place to plug it.
That's right. That's right.
I say that because I just finished reviewing a transmitter that only operates voice. It does not have a key jack, so you can have all the keys you want. There's no place to plug them. But it's a very unusual transmitter. So I'm not aware of any transceivers that doesn't have a key jack. And by the way, even if you don't want to send CW, I think having a key and a key jack is a wonderful idea because no matter what kind of operating you want to do, every now and then you want to send out a carrier for a few seconds or a part of a second while you make a watt meter measurement or you make a tuning adjustment of your antenna tuner or check your antenna tuner. You just need to send a carrier, and not all radios are equipped to do that at full power as you can with a key in the key jack.
So, that is true. Now, thinking of an external key, or really just a keyer in a transceiver, too, obviously there's the speed adjustment You also frequently see an adjustment for weighting.
Ah, yes.
Yes. You might want to address that.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I also should mention that not all keyers are created equal. The keyer in your transceiver may just be a keyer, whereas an external keyer and some transceiver keyers have memories in them.
Ah, yes.
So you can have buttons on your keyer. I used this for many years. And that each of the buttons can be set up to send a particular message, like a CQ message with your call letters, or for a contest, if you're sending out 599 FN31 in the VHF contest, it can do that with just the push of one button, which mm-hmm. is much easier to do. And not all transceivers, even those with some of them with keyers, have that capability. So that's a reason. Even if your transceiver has a basic keyer in it, you may want to have an external keyer to get those other features. The weight refers to the relationship between the dot length and the dash length. So the usual official weight is 3:1. A dash is 3 times as long as a dot, and the space between a dot and a dash is the same length as a dot. Now, why would you want to make this anything different than that? Well, one of the things is sometimes, because of the circuitry in the transmitter can actually lengthen or shorten code elements. And if that happens, you can compensate for that by changing the weight. But that's a control that, unless you really know what you're doing, I would leave it at 3:1, unless you know there's a reason to do something different, because otherwise you'll come out sending, you can send bad code with a keyer.
I've heard it, yes.
If you set it up wrong. So if you set it, for the 1:1 instead of 3:1, the dots and dashes are the same length. Very hard to decode that. One thing we didn't talk about, and this is something a lot of people take advantage of for sending CW, you can get a computer program that sends CW from the keyboard of your computer. And this is particularly good for people that can use a keyboard, but for whatever reason are not able to manipulate a electronic key or even a pump or straight key. So that's worth considering if you're in that category. And typically what happens is the serial leads of the computer, or the equivalent serial of a USB port, is closed to make the equivalent keying contact. And you can also use possibly the same software or some other software to actually decode Morse code if you're not comfortable copying it. Now, the one caveat about that is, in my experience, they work reasonably well if the code is being sent perfectly. As an example of that is W1AW code practice, which is all kind of what we call machine sent and is perfect code. And almost any software that's supposed to do this, and some radios now have it built right in, it comes up on the radio screen too, it'll decode it perfectly. But if it's not perfect code, it will not do anywhere near as good a job as you can do it by your ears if you're used to copying it. What it can be very handy for is, as part of the learning process, to kind of check your work as you go. If you're writing it down manually and then you weren't sure what happened right then, you can go back and look at the computer screen and see if you're copying code practice or something. So those are some other things you can do.
Oh, yeah. There are even Morse code decoding apps for your smartphone. I've seen those.
Ah.
Yeah. Well, are you ready for a question?
I could be.
Okay. Well, Joel Eugene, KF5RZG, is asking, I'm currently reading your book, Basic Antennas, and I was surprised to learn that antenna height has as much to do with DX performance as antenna design and quality. I'm in an area that does not allow me to get my antenna 1/2 wavelength high for 20 meters and the lower bands. What are some options I can explore to get the best DX performance from a limited antenna height?
Well, Eugene, thank you very much for mentioning my book, and I hope you continue to find it helpful. Yes, for horizontal antennas, the height above ground makes the primary difference in the elevation pattern, at least over flat terrain. Now, it's important to keep that in mind because most antenna patterns that you see are assuming a flat earth kind of thing around the antenna. The elevation pattern also depends on the ground characteristics and the terrain. Ground sloping downward away from the antenna makes it act somewhat as if the antenna were higher. So if you have a fairly low antenna, but you have ground that slopes down, as I fortunately have, not accidentally, I picked the house particularly because for about 270 degrees of azimuth, it goes down about 20 feet, which is good except when you're coming up the driveway in the winter.
Yeah.
But for RF work, it helps a lot. Another consideration is the terrain further from the antenna, and that can make low-angle radiation much less effective. If you have a nearby hill, for example, if you have very low angle radiation that's driving into the hill, unless you want to talk to somebody on that hill, which is probably not very far away, your signal won't go anywhere. So if the terrain is not flat or relatively flat around you, I recommend that you consider running a software program, High Frequency Terrain Analysis, HFTA. And this program is available in the CD-ROM at the back of recent ARL antenna books. And that can determine what the optimum elevation angles are for each direction from your specific location to anywhere else in the world. So then you know what angle you need to get where you want to go. And this takes into account the nearby hills and other things. I don't think it takes into account buildings, but it takes into account terrain. And it used to be very hard to get the needed data into the program, at least for me. But now it is quite simple, and I described the process in the November 2015 QST Doctor is In column, which is available on the ARL member webpage in the QST Digital Archive. But to get back to your original question, for most people who want to work DX but can't get a high enough horizontal antenna to get low-angle radiation, the use of a vertical monopole, or even better, an array of them, is the best choice. Now, the vertical monopole does not have as much peak gain as a low horizontal dipole, but the gain at low angles is often somewhat higher than that from the horizontal dipole. So that's usually what people do, and that's why you find that people who operate 160 meters, 80 meters, almost always use horizontal or vertical antennas for DX, because to be a half wave high on 160 meters takes about 260 feet. So, you know, who can put up a pair of 260-foot towers? Well, it's possible, I guess, but not only do you have to talk to the FAA.
Not my yard.
Yeah, you have to talk to the FAA as well as your spouse.
Yes.
And so that can be a major issue. So a vertical antenna, vertical monopole, will provide somewhat lower angle radiation if its base is raised up a little bit. Unlike a dipole, it needs one, or actually if it's self-supporting, or no supports, so you just can stand it up on the ground. You can also enhance the low-angle gain and the efficiency of a monopole by elevating the base even just a few feet, and using 2 to 4 elevated radials will provide effective efficiency similar to many buried radials, and having it up a little above the ground gets your elevation angle down a little bit, but it doesn't have the same sensitivity to height that a horizontal antenna does. And again, any kind of gain arrangements that you can make with multiple monopoles will also add to your signal strength. So that's what most people do.
Excellent. Thank you, Joel.
My pleasure.
ARRL, The Doctor is In, is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at www.arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment for the doctor, send an email to doctor@arrl.org. Background music is courtesy of Ben Sound at www.bensound.com. This program is provided under the copyright of the ARRL. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.